It replied shiveringly. Why did I think of Linton? I had read Earnshaw 20 times for Linton. I'm come home. I'd lost my way on the moor. As it spoke, I discerned obscurely a child's face looking through the window. Terror made me cruel, and finding it useless to attempt shaking the creature off, I pulled its wrists onto the broken pane and rubbed it to and fro till the blood ran down and soaked the bedclothes. Still, it wailed. Let me in! And maintained its tenacious gripe, almost maddening me with fear. How can I? I said at length. Let me go, if you want me to let you in! The fingers relaxed. I snatched mine through the hole, hurriedly piled the books up in a pyramid against it, and stopped my ears to exclude the lamentable prayer. I seemed to keep them closed above a quarter of an hour, yet the instant I listened again, there was the doleful cry moaning on.
Begone!
I shouted.
I'll never let you in, not if you beg for 20 years!
It is 20 years, mourned the voice. 20 years, I've been away for 20 years. Thereat began a feeble scratching outside, and the pile of books moved as if thrust forward. I tried to jump up, but could not stir a limb, and so yelled aloud in a frenzy of fright. To my confusion, I discovered the yell was not ideal. Hasty footsteps approached my chamber door. Somebody pushed it open with a vigorous hand, and a light glimmered through the squares at the top of the bed. I sat shuddering yet, and wiping the perspiration from my forehead, the intruder appeared to hesitate and mutter to himself. At last he said in a half whisper, plainly not expecting an answer. Is anyone here? I considered it best to confess my presence, for I knew Heathcliff's accents, and feared he might search further if I kept quiet. With this intention I turned and opened the panels. I shall not soon forget the effect my action produced. Heathcliff stood near the entrance in his shirt and trousers with a candle dripping over his fingers, and his face as white as the wall behind him. The first creak of the oak startled him like an electric shock. The light leapt from his hold to a distance of some feet, and his agitation was so extreme that he could hardly pick it up. "It is only your guest, sir," I called out, desirous to spare him the humiliation of exposing his cowardice further. "I had the misfortune to scream in my sleep owing to a frightful nightmare. I am sorry I disturbed you."
"Oh, God confound you, Mr. Lockwood. I wish you were at the..."
commenced my host, setting the candle on a chair because he found it impossible to hold it steady.
"And who showed you up into this room?"
he continued, crushing his nails into his palms and grinding his teeth to subdue the maxillary convulsions.
"Who was it? I've a good mind to turn them out of the house this moment."
"It was your servant, Zillah," I replied, flinging myself onto the floor and rapidly resuming my garments.
"I should not care if you did, Mr. Heathcliff. She richly deserves it. I suppose that she wanted to get another proof that the place was haunted, at my expense. Well, it is swarming with ghosts and goblins. You have reason in shutting it up, I assure you. No one will thank you for a doze in such a den."
"What do you mean?" asked Heathcliff. "And what are you doing? Lie down and finish out the night, since you are here. But for heaven's sake, don't repeat that horrid noise. Nothing could excuse it unless you were having your throat cut." "If the little fiend had got in at the window, she probably would have strangled me," I returned. "I'm not going to endure the persecutions of your hospitable ancestors again." "Was not the Reverend Jabez Branderham akin to you on the mother's side? And that minx, Catherine Linton, or Earnshaw, or however she was called, she must have been a changeling, a wicked little soul. She told me she had been walking the earth these 20 years, a just punishment for her mortal transgressions, I've no doubt." Scarcely were these words uttered when I recollected the association of Heathcliff's with Catherine's name in the book, which had completely slipped from my memory till thus awakened. I blushed at my inconsideration, but without showing further consciousness of the offence, I hastened to add.
"The truth is, sir, I passed the first part of the night in..."
Here I stopped afresh. I was about to say perusing those old volumes. Then it would have revealed my knowledge of their written as well as their printed contents, so correcting myself, I went on.
"In spelling over the name scratched on that window ledge. A monotonous occupation calculated to set me asleep, like counting or..." What can you mean by talking in this way to me?
Thundered Heathcliff with savage vehemence.
How dare you under my roof? God, he's mad to speak so!
And he struck his forehead with rage. I did not know whether to resent his language or pursue my explanation, but he seemed so powerfully affected that I took pity and proceeded with my dreams, affirming I had never heard the appellation of Catherine Linton before, but reading it often overproduced an impression which personified itself when I had no longer my imagination under control. Heathcliff gradually fell back into the shelter of the bed as I spoke, finally sitting down almost concealed behind it. I guessed, however, by his irregular and intercepted breathing, that he struggled to vanquish an excessive violent emotion. Not liking to show him that I had heard the conflict, I continued my toilette rather noisily, looked at my watch, and soliloquized at the length of the night.
Not 3 o'clock yet. I could have taken oath it had been 6. Time stagnates here. We must surely have retired to rest at 8.
Always at 9 in winter, and rise at 4, said my host, suppressing a groan, and as I fancied by the motion of his arm, shadowed dashing a tear from his eyes.
Mr. Lockwood, he added, you may go into my room. You'll only be in the way coming downstairs so early, and your childish outcry has sent sleep to the devil for me.
And for me too, I replied. I'll walk in the yard till daylight, and then I'll be off, and you need not dread a repetition of my intrusion. I'm now quite cured of seeking pleasure in society, be it country or town. A sensible man ought to find sufficient company in himself.
Delightful company, muttered Heathcliff. Take the candle and go where you please. I shall join you directly. Keep out of the yard, though. The dogs are unchained. And the house. Juno mounts sentinel there. And near you can only ramble about the steps and passages. But away with you. I'll come in 2 minutes.
I obeyed so far as to quit the chamber. When ignorant where the narrow lobbies led, I stood still and was witness involuntarily to a piece of superstition on the part of my landlord which belied oddly his apparent sense. He got onto the bed and wrenched open the lattice, bursting as he pulled at it into an uncontrollable passion of tears.
Come in! Come in! He sobbed. Cathy, do come! Oh, do once more! Oh, my heart's darling! Hear me this time, Catherine, at last!
The spectre showed a spectre's ordinary caprice. It gave no sign of being, but the snow and wind whirled wildly through, even reaching my station and blowing out the light. There was such anguish in the gush of grief that accompanied this raving that my compassion made me overlook its folly, and I drew off, half angry to have listened at all, and vexed at having related my ridiculous nightmare, since it produced that agony, though why was beyond my comprehension. I descended cautiously to the lower regions, and landed in the back kitchen, where a gleam of fire raked compactly together enabled me to rekindle my candle. Nothing was stirring except a brindled grey cat, which crept from the ashes and saluted me with a querulous mew. 2 benches shaped in sections of a circle nearly enclosed the hearth. On one of these I stretched myself, and Grimalkin mounted the other. We were both of us nodding ere anyone invaded our retreat, and then it was Joseph, shuffling down a wooden ladder that vanished in the roof, through a trap, the ascent to his garret, I suppose. He cast a sinister look at the little flame which I had enticed to play between the ribs, swept the cat from its elevation, and bestowing himself in the vacancy, commenced the operation of stuffing a 3-inch pipe with tobacco. My presence in his sanctum was evidently esteemed a piece of impudence, too shameful for remark. He silently applied the tube to his lips, folded his arms, and puffed away. I let him enjoy the luxury unannoyed, and after sucking out his last wreath and heaving a profound sigh, he got up and departed as solemnly as he came. A more elastic footstep entered next, and now I opened my mouth for a good morning, but closed it again. The salutation unachieved,
for Hareton Earnshaw was performing his Orison sotto voce in a series of curses directed against every object he touched, while he rummaged a corner for a spade or shovel to dig through the drifts. He glanced over the back of the bench, dilating his nostrils, and thought as little of exchanging civilities with me as with my companion the cat. I guessed by his preparations that egress was allowed, and, leaving my hard couch, made a movement to follow him. He noticed this and thrust at an inner door with the end of his spade, intimating by an inarticulate sound that there was the place where I must go, if I changed my locality. It opened into the house, where the females were already astir, Zillah urging flakes of flame up the chimney with a colossal bellows, and Mrs. Heathcliff kneeling on the hearth reading a book by the aid of the blaze. She held her hand interposed between the furnace heat and her eyes, and seemed absorbed in her occupation, desisting from it only to chide the servant for covering her with sparks, or to push away a dog now and then that snoozled its nose over forwardly into her face. I was surprised to see Heathcliff there also. He stood by the fire, his back towards me, just finishing a stormy scene with poor Zillah, who ever and anon interrupted her labour to pluck up the corner of her apron and heave an indignant groan.
"And you, you worthless!"
he broke out as I entered, turning to his daughter-in-law and employing an epithet as harmless as duck or sheep, but generally represented by a dash.
"There you are at your idle tricks again. The rest of them do earn their bread. You live on my charity. Put your trash away and find something to do. You shall pay me for the plague of having you eternally in my sight. Do you hear, damnable jade?"
"I'll put my trash away, because you can make me if I refuse," answered the young lady, closing her book and throwing it on a chair.
"But I'll not do anything, though you should swear your tongue out, except what I please."
Heathcliff lifted his hand, and the speaker sprang to a safer distance, obviously acquainted with its weight. Having no desire to be entertained by a cat-and-dog combat, I stepped forward briskly, as if eager to partake the warmth of the hearth, and innocent of any knowledge of the interrupted dispute. Each had enough decorum to suspend further hostilities. Heathcliff placed his fists, out of temptation, in his pockets. Mrs. Heathcliff curled her lip and walked to a seat far off, where she kept her word by playing the part of a statue during the remainder of my stay. That was not long. I declined joining their breakfast, and at the first gleam of dawn took an opportunity of escaping into the free air, now clear and still, and cold as impalpable ice. My landlord hallowed for me to stop ere I reached the bottom of the garden, and offered to accompany me across the moor. It was well he did, for the whole hill back was one billowy white ocean, the swells and falls not indicating corresponding rises and depressions in the ground. Many pits, at least, were filled to a level, and entire ranges of mounds, the refuse of the quarries blotted from the chart which my yesterday's walk left pictured in my mind. I had remarked on one side of the road, at intervals of 6 or 7 yards, a line of upright stones continued through the whole length of the barren. These were erected on purpose to serve as guides in the dark, and also when a fall, like the present, confounded the deep swamps on either side with the firmer path. But all traces of their existence had vanished, and my companion found it necessary to warn me frequently to steer to the right or left when I imagined I was following correctly the windings of the road. We exchanged little conversation, and he halted at the entrance of Thrushcross Park, saying I could make no error there. Our adieu were limited to a hasty bow, and then I pushed forward, trusting to my own resources. For the porter's lodge is untenanted as yet. The distance from the gate to the Grange is 2 miles. I believe I managed to make it 4, what with losing myself among the trees and sinking up to the neck in snow, a predicament which only those who have experienced it can appreciate. At any rate, whatever were my wanderings, the clock chimed 12 as I entered the house, and that gave exactly an hour for every mile of the usual way from Wuthering Heights. My human fixture and her satellites rushed to welcome me, exclaiming tumultuously they had completely given me up.
Everybody conjectured that I perished last night, and they were wondering how they must set about the search for my remains. I bid them be quiet now that they saw me returned, and benumbed to my very heart, I dragged upstairs, whence, after putting on dry clothes and pacing to and fro 30 or 40 minutes to restore the animal heat, I adjourned to my study, feeble as a kitten, almost too much so to enjoy the cheerful fire and smoking coffee which the servant had prepared for my refreshment. Chapter 4. What vain weathercocks we are! I, who had determined to hold myself independent of all social intercourse, and thanked my stars that at length I had lighted on a spot where it was next to impracticable. I, weak wretch, after maintaining till dusk a struggle with low spirits and solitude, was finally compelled to strike my colours, and under pretence of gaining information concerning the necessities of my establishment, I desired Mrs. Dean, when she brought in supper, to sit down while I ate it, hoping sincerely she would prove a regular gossip, and either rouse me to animation or lull me to sleep by her talk. "You have lived here a considerable time," I commenced. "Did you not say 16 years? 18, sir. I came when the mistress was married, to wait on her after she died. The master retained me for his housekeeper." "Indeed." There ensued a pause. She was not a gossip, I feared, unless about her own affairs, and those could hardly interest me. However, having studied for an interval with a fist on either knee and a cloud of meditation over her ruddy countenance, she ejaculated, "Ah, times are greatly changed since then." "Yes," I remarked. "You've seen a good many alterations, I suppose." "I have, and troubles too," she said. "Oh, I'll turn the talk on my landlord's family," I thought to myself. "A good subject to start. And that pretty girl widow, I should like to know her history, whether she be a native of the country or, as is more probable, an exotic that the surly indigeni will not recognize for kin." With this intention, I asked Mrs. Dean why Heathcliff let Thrushcross Grange and preferred living in a situation and residence so much inferior. "Is he not rich enough to keep the estate in good order?" I inquired. "Rich, sir," she returned. "He has nobody knows what money, and every year it increases. Yes, yes, he's rich enough to live in a finer house than this, but he's very near, close-handed, and if he had meant to flit to Thrushcross Grange, as soon as he heard of a good tenant, he could not have borne to miss the chance of getting a few hundred more. It is strange people should be so greedy when they are alone in the world." "He had a son, it seems." "Yes, he had one. He is dead." "And that young lady, Mrs. Heathcliff, is his widow?" "Yes." "Where did she come from originally?" "Why, sir, she is my late master's daughter. Catherine Linton was her maiden name. I nursed her, poor thing. I did wish Mr. Heathcliff would remove here, and then we might have been together again." "What? Catherine Linton?" I exclaimed, astonished, but a minute's reflection convinced me it was not my ghostly Catherine. Then I continued, "My predecessor's name was Linton."
"It was."
"And who is that Earnshaw, Hareton Earnshaw, who lives with Mr. Heathcliff? Are they relations?"
"No. He is the late Mrs. Linton's nephew."
"The young lady's cousin, then?"
"Yes. And her husband was her cousin also, one on the mother's, the other on the father's side. Heathcliff married Mr. Linton's sister."
"I see the house at Wuthering Heights has Earnshaw carved over the front door. Are they an old family?"
"Very old, sir, and Hareton is the last of them, as our Miss Cathy is of us. I mean of the Lintons."
"Have you been to Wuthering Heights? I beg your pardon for asking, but I should like to hear how she is."
"Mrs. Heathcliff? She looked very well and very handsome, yet I think not very happy."
"Oh dear, I don't wonder. And how did you like the master?"
"A rough fellow, rather, Mrs. Dean. Is not that his character?"
"Rough as a sore edge, and hard as whinstone. The less you meddle with him, the better.
He must have had some ups and downs in life to make him such a churl. Do you know anything of his history?
It's a cuckoo, sir. I know all about it, except where he was born and who were his parents and how he got his money at first. And Hareton has been cast out like an unfledged dunnock. The unfortunate lad is the only one in all this parish that does not guess how he has been cheated.
Well, Mrs. Dean, it will be a charitable deed to tell me something of my neighbours. I feel I shall not rest if I go to bed. So be good enough to sit and chat an hour.
Oh, certainly, sir. I'll just fetch a little sewing, and then I'll sit as long as you please. But you've caught cold. I saw you shivering, and you must have some gruel to drive it out.
The worthy woman bustled off, and I crouched near the fire. My head felt hot, and the rest of me chill. Moreover, I was excited almost to a pitch of foolishness, through my nerves and brain. This caused me to feel not uncomfortable, but rather fearful, as I am still, of serious effects from the incidents of today and yesterday. She returned presently, bringing a smoking basin and a basket of work, and having placed the former on the hob, drew in her seat, evidently pleased to find me so companionable.
"Before I came to live here,"
she commenced, waiting no farther invitation to her story,
"I was almost always at Wuthering Heights, because my mother had nursed Mr. Hindley Earnshaw. That was Hareton's father, and I got used to playing with the children. I ran errands, too, and helped to make hay, and hung about the farm ready for anything that anybody would set me to. One fine summer morning, it was the beginning of harvest, I remember, Mr. Earnshaw, the old master, came downstairs dressed for a journey, and after he had told Joseph what was to be done during the day, he turned to Hindley and Cathy and me, for I sat eating my porridge with them, and he said, speaking to his son, 'Now, my bonny man, I'm going to Liverpool today. What shall I bring you? You may choose what you like. Only let it be little, for I shall walk there and back 60 miles each way. That is a long spell.' Hindley named a fiddle, and then he asked Miss Cathy. She was hardly 6 years old, but she could ride any horse in the stable, and she chose a whip. He did not forget me, for he had a kind heart. And though he was rather severe sometimes, he promised to bring me a pocketful of apples and pears, and then he kissed his children, said goodbye, and set off. It seemed a long while to us all, the 3 days of his absence, and often did little Cathy ask when he would be home. Mrs. Earnshaw expected him by supper time on the third evening, and she put the meal off hour after hour. There were no signs of his coming, however, and at last the children got tired of running down to the gate to look. Then it grew dark. She would have had them to bed, but they begged sadly to be allowed to stay up. And just about 11 o'clock the door latch was raised quietly, and in stepped the master. He threw himself into a chair, laughing and groaning, and bid them all stand off, for he was nearly killed. He would not have such another walk for 3 kingdoms.
"And at the end of it to be flighted to death," he said, opening his great coat, which he held bundled up in his arms. "See here, wife? I was never so beaten with anything in my life, but you must e'en take it as a gift of God, though it's as dark almost as if it came from the devil."
We crowded round, and over Miss Cathy's head I had a peep at a dirty, ragged, black-haired child, big enough both to walk and talk. Indeed, its face looked older than Catherine's, yet when it was set on its feet, it only stared round and repeated over and over again some gibberish that nobody could understand. I was frightened, and Mrs. Earnshaw was ready to fling it out of doors. She did fly up, asking how he could fashion to bring that gypsy brat into the house when they had their own bairns to feed and fend for, what he meant to do with it, and whether he were mad. The master tried to explain the matter, but he was really half dead with fatigue, and all that I could make out amongst her scolding was a tale of his seeing it starving and houseless, and as good as dumb in the streets of Liverpool, where he picked it up and inquired for its owner. Not a soul knew to whom it belonged, he said, and his money and time being both limited, he thought it better to take it home with him at once than run into vain expenses there, because he was determined he would not leave it as he found it. Well, the conclusion was that my mistress grumbled herself calm, and Mr. Earnshaw told me to wash it and give it clean things and let it sleep with the children.
Hindley and Cathy contented themselves with looking and listening till peace was restored. Then both began searching their father's pockets for the presents he had promised them. The former was a boy of 14, but when he drew out what had been a fiddle, crushed to morsels in the great coat, he blubbered aloud. And Cathy, when she learned the master had lost her whip in attending on the stranger, showed her humour by grinning and spitting at the stupid little thing, earning for her pains a sound blow from her father to teach her cleaner manners. They entirely refused to have it in bed with them, or even in their room, and I had no more sense, so I put it on the landing of the stairs, hoping it might be gone on the morrow. By chance, or else attracted by hearing his voice, it crept to Mr. Earnshaw's door, and there he found it on quitting his chamber. Inquiries were made as to how it got there. I was obliged to confess, and in recompense for my cowardice and inhumanity, was sent out of the house. This was Heathcliff's first introduction to the family. On coming back a few days afterwards, for I did not consider my banishment perpetual, I found they had christened him Heathcliff. It was the name of a son who died in childhood, and it has served him ever since, both for Christian and surname. Miss Cathy and he were now very thick, but Hindley hated him, and to say the truth, I did the same, and we plagued and went on with him shamefully, for I wasn't reasonable enough to feel my injustice, and the mistress never put in a word on his behalf when she saw him wronged. He seemed a sullen, patient child, hardened perhaps to ill-treatment. He would stand Hindley's blows without winking or shedding a tear, and my pinches moved him only to draw in a breath and open his eyes as if he had hurt himself by accident, and nobody was to blame. This endurance made old Earnshaw furious. When he discovered his son persecuting the poor fatherless child, as he called him, he took to Heathcliff strangely, believing all he said. For that matter, he said precious little and generally the truth, and petting him up far above Cathy, who was too mischievous and wayward for a favourite. So, from the very beginning, he bred bad feeling in the house, and at Mrs. Earnshaw's death, which happened in less than 2 years after, the young master had learned to regard his father as an oppressor rather than a friend, and Heathcliff as a usurper of his parents' affections and his privileges, and he grew bitter with brooding over these injuries. I sympathised a while, but when the children fell ill of the measles, and I had to tend to them and take on me the cares of a woman at once, I changed my idea. Heathcliff was dangerously sick, and while he lay at the worst, he would have me constantly by his pillow. I suppose he felt I did a good deal for him, and he hadn't wit to guess that I was compelled to do it. However, I will say this, he was the quietest child that ever nurse watched over. The difference between him and the others forced me to be less partial. Cathy and her brother harassed me terribly. He was as uncomplaining as a lamb, though hardness, not gentleness, made him give little trouble. He got through, and the doctor affirmed it was in a great measure owing to me, and praised me for my care. I was vain of his commendations, and softened towards the being by whose means I earned them, and thus Hindley lost his last ally. Still, I couldn't dote on Heathcliff, and I wondered often what my master saw to admire so much in the sullen boy, who never to my recollection repaid his indulgence by any sign of gratitude. He was not insolent to his benefactor. He was simply insensible, though knowing perfectly the hold he had on his heart, and conscious he had only to speak and all the house would be obliged to bend to his wishes. As an instance, I remember Mr. Earnshaw once bought a couple of colts at the parish fair and gave the lads each one. Heathcliff took the handsomest, but it soon fell lame, and when he discovered it, he said to Hindley, "You must exchange horses with me. I don't like mine. And if you won't, I shall tell your father of the 3 thrashings you've given me this week, and show him my arm, which is black to the shoulder." Hindley put out his tongue and cuffed him over the ears. "You'd better do it at once," he persisted, escaping to the porch. They were in the stable. "You will have to, and if I speak of these blows, you get them again with interest." "Off, dog," cried Hindley, threatening him with an iron weight used for weighing potatoes and hay. "Throw it," he replied, standing still,
and then I'll tell how you boasted that you would turn me out of doors as soon as he died, and see whether he will not turn you out directly.
Hindley threw it, hitting him on the breast, and down he fell, but staggered up immediately, breathless and white. And had not I prevented it, he would have gone just so to the master, and got full revenge by letting his condition plead for him, intimating who had caused it.
"Take my colt, gypsy, then," said young Earnshaw, "and I pray that he may break your neck. Take him and be damned, you beggarly interloper, and wheedle my father out of all he has. Only afterwards show him what you are, imp of Satan. And take that, I hope he'll kick out your brains."
Heathcliff had gone to loose the beast and shift it to his own stall. He was passing behind it when Hindley finished his speech by knocking him under its feet, and without stopping to examine whether his hopes were fulfilled, ran away as fast as he could. I was surprised to witness how coolly the child gathered himself up, and went on with his intention, exchanging saddles and all, and then sitting down on a bundle of hay to overcome the qualm which the violent blow occasioned before he entered the house. I persuaded him easily to let me lay the blame of his bruises on the horse. He minded little what tale was told, since he had what he wanted. He complained so seldom indeed of such stirs as these that I really thought him not vindictive. I was deceived completely, as you will hear. Chapter 5. In the course of time, Mr. Earnshaw began to fail. He had been active and healthy, yet his strength left him suddenly. And when he was confined to the chimney corner, he grew grievously irritable. And nothing vexed him. And suspected slights of his authority nearly threw him into fits. This was especially to be remarked if anyone attempted to impose upon or domineer over his favourite. He was painfully jealous lest a word should be spoken amiss to him, seeming to have got into his head the notion that, because he liked Heathcliff, all hated and longed to do him an ill turn. It was a disadvantage to the lad, for the kinder among us did not wish to fret the master, so we humoured his partiality, and that humouring was rich nourishment to the child's pride and black tempers. Still, it became in a manner necessary. Twice or thrice, Hindley's manifestation of scorn, while his father was near, roused the old man to a fury. He seized his stick to strike him, and shook with rage that he could not do it. At last our curate, we had a curate then, who made the living answer by teaching the little Lintons and Earnshaws, and farming his bit of land himself, advised that the young man should be sent to college, and Mr. Earnshaw agreed, though with a heavy spirit, for he said, "Hindley was not, and would never thrive as where he wandered." I hoped heartily we should have peace now. It hurt me to think the master should be made uncomfortable by his own good deed. I fancied the discontent of age and disease arose from his family disagreements, as he would have it that it did. Really, you know, sir, it was in his sinking frame. We might have got on tolerably, notwithstanding, but for two people, Miss Cathy and Joseph the servant. You saw him, I dare say, up yonder. He was and is yet most likely the wearisomest, self-righteous Pharisee that ever ransacked a Bible to rake the promises to himself and fling the curses to his neighbours. By his knack of sermonising and pious discoursing, he contrived to make a great impression on Mr. Earnshaw, and the more feeble the master became, the more influence he gained. He was relentless in worrying him about his soul's concerns, and about ruling his children rigidly. He encouraged him to regard Hindley as a reprobate, and night after night he regularly grumbled out a long string of tales against Heathcliff and Catherine, always minding to flatter Earnshaw's weakness by heaping the heaviest blame on the latter. Certainly, she had ways with her such as I never saw a child take up before, and she put all of us past our patience 50 times and oftener in a day. From the hour she came downstairs till the hour she went to bed, we had not a minute's security that she wouldn't be in mischief. Her spirits were always at high water mark, her tongue always going, singing, laughing, and plaguing everybody who would not do the same. A wild, wicked slip she was.
but she had the bonniest eye, the sweetest smile, and lightest foot in the parish. And after all, I believe she meant no harm, for when once she made you cry in good earnest, it seldom happened that she would not keep you company and oblige you to be quiet that you might comfort her. She was much too fond of Heathcliff. The greatest punishment we could invent for her was to keep her separate from him, yet she got chided more than any of us on his account. In play, she liked exceedingly to act the little mistress, using her hands freely and commanding her companions. She did so to me, but I would not bear slapping and ordering, and so I let her know. Now, Mr. Earnshaw did not understand jokes from his children. He had always been strict and grave with them, and Catherine, on her part, had no idea why her father should be crosser and less patient in his ailing condition than he was in his prime. His peevish reproofs wakened in her a naughty delight to provoke him. She was never so happy as when we were all scolding her at once, and she defying us with her bold, saucy look and her ready words, turning Joseph's religious curses into ridicule, baiting me and doing just what her father hated most, showing how her pretended insolence, which he thought real, had more power over Heathcliff than his kindness. How the boy would do her bidding in anything, and his only when it suited his own inclination. After behaving as bad as possible all day, she sometimes came fondling to make it up at night. "Nay, Cathy," the old man would say, "I cannot love thee, thou art worse than thy brother. Go say thy prayers, child, and ask God's pardon. I doubt thy mother and I must rue that we ever reared thee." That made her cry at first, and then, being repulsed, continually hardened her, and she laughed if I told her to say she was sorry for her faults and begged to be forgiven. But the hour came at last that ended Mr. Earnshaw's troubles on earth. He died quietly in his chair one October evening, seated by the fireside. A high wind blustered round the house and roared in the chimney. It sounded wild and stormy, yet it was not cold and we were all together. I, a little removed from the hearth, busy at my knitting, and Joseph reading his Bible near the table, for the servants generally sat in the house then, after their work was done. Miss Cathy had been sick, and that made her still. She leant against her father's knee, and Heathcliff was lying on the floor with his head in her lap. I remember the master before he fell into a doze, stroking her bonny hair. It pleased him rarely to see her gentle, and saying, "Why canst thou not always be a good lass, Cathy?" And she turned her face up to his and laughed and answered, "Why cannot you always be a good man, father?" But as soon as she saw him vexed again, she kissed his hand and said she would sing him to sleep. She began singing very low, till his fingers dropped from hers and his head sank on his breast. Then I told her to hush and not stir for fear she should wake him. We all kept as mute as mice a full half hour, and should have done so longer, only Joseph, having finished his chapter, got up and said that he must rouse the master for prayers and bed. He stepped forward and called him by name and touched his shoulder, but he would not move, so he took the candle and looked at him. I thought there was something wrong as he set down the light, and seizing the children each by an arm, whispered them to frame upstairs and make little din. They might pray alone that evening. He had something to do. "I shall bid father good night first," said Catherine, putting her arms around his neck, before we could hinder her. The poor thing discovered her loss directly. She screamed out, "Oh, he's dead! Heathcliff, he's dead!" And they both set up a heartbreaking cry. I joined my wail to theirs, loud and bitter. But Joseph asked what we could be thinking of to roar in that way over a saint in heaven. He told me to put on my cloak and run to Gimmerton for the doctor and the parson. I could not guess the use that either would be of then. However, I went through wind and rain and brought one, the doctor, back with me. The other said he would come in the morning. Leaving Joseph to explain matters, I ran to the children's room. Their door was ajar. I saw they had never lain down, though it was past midnight. But they were calmer, and did not need me to console them. The little souls were comforting each other with better thoughts than I could have hit on. No parson in the world ever pictured heaven so beautifully as they did in their innocent talk.
and while I sobbed and listened, I could not help wishing we were all there, safe together.
Chapter 6. Mr. Hindley came home to the funeral, and a thing that amazed us and set the neighbours gossiping right and left. He brought a wife with him. What she was and where she was born, he never informed us. Probably she had neither money nor name to recommend her, or he would scarcely have kept the union from his father. She was not one that would have disturbed the house much on her own account. Every object she saw, the moment she crossed the threshold, appeared to delight her, and every circumstance that took place about her, except the preparing for the burial and the presence of the mourners. I thought she was half silly from her behaviour while that went on. She ran into her chamber and made me come with her, though I should have been dressing the children, and there she sat shivering and clasping her hands and asking repeatedly, "Are they gone yet?" Then she began describing with hysterical emotion the effect it produced on her to see black, and started and trembled and at last fell a-weeping. And when I asked what was the matter, answered she didn't know, but she felt so afraid of dying. I imagined her as little likely to die as myself. She was rather thin, but young and fresh-complexioned, and her eyes sparkled as bright as diamonds. I did remark, to be sure, that mounting the stairs made her breathe very quick, that the least sudden noise set her all a-quiver, and that she coughed troublesomely sometimes. But I knew nothing of what these symptoms portended, and had no impulse to sympathise with her. "We don't in general take to foreigners here, Mr. Lockwood, unless they take to us first." Young Earnshaw was altered considerably in the 3 years of his absence. He had grown sparer and lost his colour, and spoke and dressed quite differently. And on the very day of his return, he told Joseph and me we must thenceforth quarter ourselves in the back kitchen and leave the house for him. Indeed, he would have carpeted and papered a small spare room for a parlour, but his wife expressed such pleasure at the white floor and huge glowing fireplace, at the pewter dishes and delf case and dog kennel, and the wide space there was to move about in where they usually sat, that he thought it unnecessary to her comfort, and so dropped the intention. She expressed pleasure, too, at finding a sister among her new acquaintance, and she prattled to Catherine and kissed her and ran about with her and gave her quantities of presents at the beginning. Her affection tired very soon, however, and when she grew peevish, Hindley became tyrannical. A few words from her, evincing a dislike to Heathcliff, were enough to rouse in him all his old hatred of the boy. He drove him from their company to the servants, deprived him of the instructions of the curate, and insisted that he should labour out of doors instead, compelling him to do so as hard as any other lad on the farm. Heathcliff bore his degradation pretty well at first, because Cathy taught him what she learnt and worked or played with him in the fields. They both promised fair to grow up as rude as savages, the young master being entirely negligent how they behaved and what they did, so they kept clear of him. He would not even have seen after their going to church on Sundays, only Joseph and the curate reprimanded his carelessness when they absented themselves, and that reminded him to order Heathcliff a flogging and Catherine a fast from dinner or supper. But it was one of their chief amusements to run away to the moors in the morning and remain there all day, and the after-punishment grew a mere thing to laugh at. The curate might set as many chapters as he pleased for Catherine to get by heart, and Joseph might thrash Heathcliff till his arm ached. They forgot everything the minute they were together again, at least the minute they had contrived some naughty plan of revenge. And many a time I've cried to myself to watch them growing more reckless daily, and I not daring to speak a syllable for fear of losing the small power I still retained over the unfriended creatures. One Sunday evening it chanced that they were banished from the sitting room, for making a noise or a light offence of the kind, and when I went to call them to supper, I could discover them nowhere. We searched the house, above and below, and the yard and the stables, they were invisible. And at last Hindley, in a passion, told us to bolt the doors and swore nobody should let them in that night. The household went to bed, and I too, anxious to lie down, opened my lattice and put my head out to hearken, though it rained, determined to admit them in spite of the prohibition should they return.
In a while I distinguished steps coming up the road, and the light of a lantern glimmered through the gate. I threw a shawl over my head and ran to prevent them from waking Mr. Earnshaw by knocking. There was Heathcliff, by himself. Gave me a start to see him alone.
"Where is Miss Catherine?"
I cried hurriedly. "No accident, I hope." "At Thrushcross Grange," he answered, and I would have been there too, but they had not the manners to ask me to stay.
"Well, you will catch it," I said. "You'll never be content till you're sent about your business. What in the world led you wandering to Thrushcross Grange?"
"Oh, let me get off my wet clothes and I'll tell you all about it, Nelly," he replied. I bid him beware of rousing the master, and while he undressed and I waited to put out the candle, he continued. "Cathy and I escaped from the washhouse to have a ramble at liberty, and getting a glimpse of the Grange lights, we thought we would just go and see whether the Lintons passed their Sunday evenings standing shivering in corners while their father and mother sat eating and drinking and singing and laughing and burning their eyes out before the fire. Do you think they do? Or reading sermons and being catechised by their manservant and set to learn a column of scripture names if they don't answer properly?"
"Probably not," I responded. "They are good children, no doubt, and don't deserve the treatment you receive for your bad conduct."
"Don't cant, Nelly," he said.
"Nonsense."
We ran from the top of the heights to the park without stopping. Catherine completely beaten in the race because she was barefoot. You'll have to seek for her shoes in the bog tomorrow. We crept through a broken hedge, groped our way up the path and planted ourselves in a flower pot under the drawing room window. The light came from thence. They had not put up the shutters, and the curtains were only half closed. Both of us were able to look in by standing on the basement and clinging to the ledge, and we saw. Ah, it was beautiful! A splendid place carpeted with crimson, and crimson-covered chairs and tables, and a pure white ceiling bordered by gold. A shower of glass drops hanging in silver chains from the centre, and shimmering with little soft tapers. Old Mr. and Mrs. Linton were not there. Edgar and his sisters had it entirely to themselves. Shouldn't they have been happy? We should have thought ourselves in heaven. And now guess what your good children were doing. Isabella, I believe she's 11, a year younger than Cathy, lay screaming at the farther end of the room, shrieking as if witches were running red-hot needles into her. Edgar stood on the hearth, weeping silently, and in the middle of the table sat a little dog, shaking its paw and yelping, which from their mutual accusations we understood they had nearly pulled in two between them, the idiots. That was their pleasure, to quarrel who should hold a heap of warm hair, and each begin to cry because both, after struggling to get it, refused to take it. We laughed outright at the petted things. We did despise them. When would you catch me wishing to have what Catherine wanted? Or find us by ourselves seeking entertainment in yelling and sobbing and rolling on the ground, divided by the whole room? I'd not exchange for 1,000 lives my condition here for Edgar Linton's at Thrushcross Grange. Not if I might have the privilege of flinging Joseph off the highest gable and painting the house front with Hindley's blood.
"Hush! Hush!" I interrupted. "Still you have not told me, Heathcliff, how Catherine is left behind."
"I told you we laughed," he answered. "The Lintons heard us, and with one accord they shot like arrows to the door." There was silence and then a cry.
"Oh, Mama! Mama! Oh, Papa! Oh, Mama, come here! Oh, Papa, oh!"
They really did howl out something in that way. We made frightful noises to terrify them still more, and then we dropped off the ledge because somebody was drawing the bars, and we felt we had better flee. I had Cathy by the hand and was urging her on, when all at once she fell down.
"Run, Heathcliff, run!"
she whispered.
"They have let the bulldog loose and he holds me!"
The devil had seized her ankle, Nelly. I heard his abominable snorting. She did not yell out, no. She would have scorned to do it if she had been spitted on the horns of a mad cow. I did, though. I vociferated curses enough to annihilate any fiend in Christendom, and I got a stone and thrust it between its jaws, and I tried with all my might to cram it down its throat. A beast of a servant came up with a lantern at last, shouting, "Keep fast, Skulker, keep fast!" He changed his note, however, when he saw Skulker's game. The dog was throttled off, his huge purple tongue hanging half a foot out of his mouth,
and his pendant lips streaming with bloody slaver. The man took Kathy up. She was sick, not from fear, I'm certain, but from pain. He carried her in. I followed, grumbling execrations and vengeance.
"What prey, Robert?"
hallowed Linton from the entrance.
"Skulkers caught a little girl, sir," he replied. "And there's a lad here," he added, making a clutch at me, "who looks an out-and-outer,
very like the robbers were for putting them through the window to open the doors to the gang after all were asleep, and they might murder us at their ease. Hold your tongue, you foul-mouthed thief, you. You shall go to the gallows for this. Mr. Linton, sir, don't lay by your gun."
"No, no, Robert," said the old fool. "The rascals knew that yesterday was my rent day. They thought to have me cleverly. Come in. I'll furnish them a reception.
There, John, fasten the chain. Give Skulker some water, Jenny. To beard a magistrate in his stronghold and on the Sabbath, too. Where will their insolence stop? Oh, my dear Mary, look here. Don't be afraid, it is but a boy. That the villain scowls so plainly in his face, would it not be a kindness to the country to hang him at once, before he shows his nature in acts as well as features?" He pulled me under the chandelier, and Mrs. Linton placed her spectacles on her nose and raised her hands in horror. The cowardly children crept nearer also, Isabella lisping.
"Frightful thing. Put him in the cellar, Papa. He's exactly like the son of a fortune-teller that stole my tame pheasant, isn't he, Edgar?"
While they examined me, Kathy came round. She heard the last speech and laughed. Edgar Linton, after an inquisitive stare, collected sufficient wit to recognise her. "They see us at church, you know, though we seldom meet them elsewhere."
"That's Miss Earnshaw," he whispered to his mother. "And look how Skulker has bitten her, how her foot bleeds."
"Miss Earnshaw? Nonsense!" cried the dame. "Miss Earnshaw scouring the country with Gypsy? And yet, my dear, the child is in mourning. Surely it is, and she may be lamed for life."
"What culpable carelessness in her brother," exclaimed Mr. Linton, turning from me to Catherine.
"I've understood from Shielders."
"That was the curate, sir. That he lets her grow up in absolute heathenism. But who is this? Where does she pick up this companion?"
"Oh, I declare, he is that strange acquisition my late neighbour made in his journey to Liverpool. A little Lascar, or an American or Spanish castaway."
"A wicked boy, at all events," remarked the old lady. "And quite unfit for a decent house. Did you notice his language, Linton? I'm shocked that my children should have heard it."
I recommenced cursing. "Don't be angry, Nelly." And Sir Robert was ordered to take me off. I refused to go without Cathy. He dragged me into the garden, pushed the lantern into my hand, assured me that Mr. Earnshaw should be informed of my behaviour, and bidding me march directly secured the door again. The curtains were still looped up at one corner, and I resumed my station as spy, because if Catherine had wished to return, I intended shattering their great glass panes to a million of fragments unless they let her out. She sat on the sofa quietly. Mrs. Linton took off the grey cloak of the dairymaid which we had borrowed for our excursion. Shaking her head and expostulating with her, I suppose she was a young lady and they made a distinction between her treatment and mine. Then the woman servant brought a basin of warm water and washed her feet, and Mr. Linton mixed a tumbler of negus, and Isabella emptied a plateful of cakes into her lap, and Edgar stood gaping at a distance. Afterwards they dried and combed her beautiful hair, and gave her a pair of enormous slippers, and wheeled her to the fire. And I left her as merry as she could be, dividing her food between the little dog and Skulker, whose nose she pinched as he ate, and kindling a spark of spirit in the vacant blue eyes of the Lintons, a dim reflection from her own enchanting face. I saw they were full of stupid admiration. She is so immeasurably superior to them, to everybody on earth, is she not, Nelly?
"There will be more come of this business than you reckon on," I answered, covering him up and extinguishing the light. "You are incurable, Heathcliff, and Mr. Hindley will have to proceed to extremities, see if he won't."
My words came truer than I desired. The luckless adventure made Earnshaw furious, and then Mr. Linton, to mend matters, paid us a visit himself on the morrow, and read the young master such a lecture on the road he guided his family that he was stirred to look about him in earnest. Heathcliff received no flogging, but he was told that the first word he spoke to Miss Catherine should ensure a dismissal, and Mrs. Earnshaw undertook to keep her sister-in-law in due restraint when she returned home, employing art, not force. With force, she would have found it impossible. Chapter 7 Cathy stayed at Thrushcross Grange 5 weeks till Christmas. By that time her ankle was thoroughly cured and her manners much improved. The mistress visited her often in the interval and commenced her plan of reform by trying to raise her self-respect with fine clothes and flattery, which she took readily, so that instead of a wild, hatless little savage jumping into the house and rushing to squeeze us all breathless, there lighted from a handsome black pony a very dignified person with brown ringlets falling from the cover of a feathered beaver and a long cloth habit, which she was obliged to hold up with both hands that she might sail in. Hindley lifted her from her horse, exclaiming delightedly, "Why, Cathy, you are quite a beauty. I should scarcely have known you. You look like a lady now. Isabella Linton is not to be compared with her, is she, Francis?"
"Isabella has not her natural advantages," replied his wife. "But she must mind and not grow wild again here. Ellen, help Miss Catherine off with her things. Stay, dear, you will disarrange your curls. Let me untie your hat." I removed the habit, and there shone forth beneath a grand plaid silk frock, white trousers and burnished shoes, and while her eyes sparkled joyfully when the dogs came bounding up to welcome her, she dared hardly touch them lest they should fawn upon her splendid garments. She kissed me gently. I was all flour making the Christmas cake, and it would not have done to give me a hug, and then she looked round for Heathcliff. Mr. and Mrs. Earnshaw watched anxiously their meeting, thinking it would enable them to judge in some measure what grounds they had for hoping to succeed in separating the two friends. Heathcliff was hard to discover at first. If he were careless and uncared for before Catherine's absence, he had been 10 times more so since. Nobody but I even did him the kindness to call him a dirty boy and bid him wash himself once a week, and children of his age seldom have a natural pleasure in soap and water. Therefore, not to mention his clothes, which had seen 3 months' service in mire and dust, and his thick, uncombed hair, the surface of his face and hands was dismally beclouded. He might well skulk behind the settle on beholding such a bright, graceful damsel enter the house instead of a rough-headed counterpart of himself as he expected. "Is Heathcliff not here?" she demanded, pulling off her gloves and displaying fingers wonderfully whitened with doing nothing and staying indoors.
"Heathcliff, you may come forward,"
cried Mr. Hindley, enjoying his discomfiture, and gratified to see what a forbidding young blackguard he would be compelled to present himself.
"You may come and wish Miss Catherine welcome like the other servants."
Cathy, catching a glimpse of her friend in his concealment, flew to embrace him. She bestowed 7 or 8 kisses on his cheek within the second, and then stopped, and drawing back, burst into a laugh, exclaiming,
"Why, how very black and cross you look! And how funny and grim!
But that's because I'm used to Edgar and Isabella Linton. Well, Heathcliff, have you forgotten me?" She had some reason to put the question, for shame and pride threw double gloom over his countenance and kept him immovable.
"Shake hands, Heathcliff,"
said Mr. Earnshaw condescendingly.
"Once in a way that is permitted."
"I shall not," replied the boy, finding his tongue at last. "I shall not stand to be laughed at. I shall not bear it." And he would have broken from the circle, but Miss Cathy seized him again. "I did not mean to laugh at you," she said. "I could not hinder myself, Heathcliff. Shake hands at least. What are you sulky for? It was only that you looked odd. If you wash your face and brush your hair, it will be all right. But you are so dirty." She gazed concernedly at the dusky fingers she held in her own, and also at her dress, which she feared had gained no embellishment from its contact with his. "You needn't have touched me," he answered, following her eye and snatching his hand away. "I shall be dirty as I please, and I like to be dirty, and I will be dirty." With that, he dashed headforemost out of the room, amid the merriment of the master and mistress, and to the serious disturbance of Catherine,
who could not comprehend how her remarks should have produced such an exhibition of bad temper. After playing lady's maid to the newcomer, and putting my cakes in the oven and making the house and kitchen cheerful with great fires befitting Christmas Eve, I prepared to sit down and amuse myself by singing carols all alone, regardless of Joseph's affirmations that he considered the merry tunes I chose as next door to songs. He had retired to private prayer in his chamber, and Mr. and Mrs. Earnshaw were engaging Missy's attention by sundry gay trifles bought for her to present to the little Lintons as an acknowledgement of their kindness. They had invited them to spend the morrow at Wuthering Heights, and the invitation had been accepted on one condition. Mrs. Linton begged that her darlings might be kept carefully apart from that naughty swearing boy. Under these circumstances I remained solitary. I smelt the rich scent of the heating spices, and admired the shining kitchen utensils, the polished clock decked in holly, the silver mugs ranged on a tray ready to be filled with mulled ale for supper, and above all, the speckless purity of my particular care, the scoured and well-swept floor. I gave due inward applause to every object, and then I remembered how old Earnshaw used to come in when all was tidied, and call me a cant lass, and slip a shilling into my hand as a Christmas box. And from that I went on to think of his fondness for Heathcliff, and his dread lest he should suffer neglect after death had removed him, and that naturally led me to consider the poor lad's situation now. And from singing, I changed my mind to crying. It struck me soon, however. There would be more sense in endeavouring to repair some of his wrongs than shedding tears over him. I got up and walked into the court to seek him. He was not far. I found him smoothing the glossy coat of the new pony in the stable, and feeding the other beasts according to custom.
"Make haste, Heathcliff," I said. "The kitchen is so comfortable, and Joseph is upstairs. Make haste! And let me dress you smart before Miss Cathy comes out, and then you can sit together, with the whole hearth to yourselves, and have a long chat until bedtime."
He proceeded with his task and never turned his head towards me.
"Come, are you coming?"
I continued. "There's a little cake for each of you, nearly enough, and you'll need half an hour's donning." I waited 5 minutes, but getting no answer left him. Catherine supped with her brother and sister-in-law. Joseph and I joined at an unsociable meal seasoned with reproofs on one side and sauciness on the other. His cake and cheese remained on the table all night for the fairies. He managed to continue work till 9 o'clock, and then marched dumb and dour to his chamber.